You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, June 10th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Leon Botstein. In his piece in Democracy Journal, Are We Still Making Citizens? Also on the program today, Roe v. Wade attacked by the Fifth Circuit. Iraq part deux, or trois, depending on how you're counting. Meanwhile, Don Rumsfeld scurries like a rat off that ship, and then scurries back on it, and then back off it. King v. Burwell has the Republicans extremely concerned, as well it should. House votes to cut Amtrak funding. Of course it does. We don't want to invest in our infrastructure, folks. The cop from McKinney resigns. I hope it is just a precursor to his spending some time in the clink, as it were. It appears that the fast-track vote is coming on Friday. Time to make some phone calls, folks. And update on the clown car. Bush is nervous. Santorum lonely. Graham apparently has got plenty of ladies. And Rick Perry still not so bright. It really just goes to show you the glasses. It does. It's not all the glasses, folks. The glasses can help, but you still actually have to put a sentence together. So it also turns out that it wasn't just the back medication. But well, we will get to that shortly. Well, first off, for those of you who are members and listen to the second half of the program, you know this probably already. But for those of you who are not aware of it, we have an intern for the summer. I think this is our first successfully executed arrival of an intern. We've had some near misses. Noah is with us. Noah, you're a college student, is that correct? And let's get Noah on the mic for a second. Just for a second. We're just going to dribs and drabs of information about you. Mm-hmm. What college do you attend?
Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Reed College in Portland, Oregon. All right. Well, Noah, you can sit back down. We're not gonna.
Hey, wow.
Great work culture.
We're not going to. Well, that's what I wanted to talk about. Fortunately, the timing of this couldn't have been better. The Wall Street Journal released a memo that was sent to interns at Barclays, at the investment bank, and it is 10 commandments for Wall Street interns, but we generally follow the same rules. So I'm reading from this banker's memo sent out to the incoming intern class of 2015, of which you are a member. Now, look at this, Michael. He's taking notes. Yeah, that's good to hear.
He's good. He's well-trained.
All right, I'm going to give you the entire memo, but I'm going to read some of the highlights. Number one, our group dresses very conservatively. Men, on your first day at the desk, it's customary to wear a bow tie or suspenders. All right? Now, you missed that, but I'll give you a second bite at the apple tomorrow. Remember, this is number two, this is a summer internship for a full-time offer. Well, that's not quite true. It won't be easy, but if you can't handle the heat, get out of the kitchen. Now, coincidentally, you are arguably sitting in what could be considered our kitchen. Fortunately for you, there's no stove there, so there's actually no more heat there than there is anywhere else. Number three, we expect you to be the last ones to leave every night, no matter what. Now, the good news for you is, the way that Michael skedaddles out of this office, you wouldn't have to stay very long. You should enjoy your casual 9:15 a.m. Pacific time arrival this Friday, but I wouldn't get used to it.
Oh, that's for me.
That's for Matt. And number five, never take your jacket off at work. Okay? Keep that in mind. And you'll be assigned junior mentors. That's Michael. You've met him. It's much appreciated if you bring breakfast for your respective mentor. It's in quotes.
That is correct.
And number seven, I recommend bringing a pillow to the office. A yoga mat works as well.
We've been through this. This is the part I covered in detail.
Michael brings a yoga mat. It makes sleeping under your desk a lot more comfortable. In the very likely scenario that you have to do that. Now, Michael never sleeps under his desk, but he does bring a yoga mat in. But I think that's mostly just a sort of a conversation piece for folks in the elevator. Like, oh, yeah, it's yoga. That's it.
Not your strongest.
No. No, they can't all be gems. Folks, just a reminder, this program is sponsored for just literally another couple of days by Credo Mobile. They've got a great deal for Majority Report listeners. You know all about Credo Mobile. We heard Becky Bond yesterday tell us about the company. They are still working diligently on fighting Fast Track Authority, among other things, trying to open up the debates so that we hear more from the likes of Bernie Sanders et al. They are offering Majority Report listeners a great deal. $100 off any new phone, 25% off your data fees for the first year. You can go to credomobile.com/majority report to get a part of the deal. You can also get more information on this. If you forget what the code is, go to majority.fm, click on support our sponsors. You can get all the information there. Credo Mobile, America's only progressive phone company. You can be a part of it. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, an interview that I recorded yesterday afternoon with Leon Botstein. He is the president of Bard College. And he's got a piece in the Democracy Journal, Are We Still Making Citizens? Well, we spoke to him in Vienna, Austria. We didn't go there. We called. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Leon Botstein. We are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program president of the college and the Leon Levy Professor in the Arts and Humanities at Bard College, Leon Botstein, on his piece in Democracy Journal, Are We Still Making Citizens? Welcome to the program, Leon.
Hi. I'm glad to be there.
I want to get into, obviously your question centers around education and as to whether or not we are still, I guess, I don't think it's appropriate to say in the business of making citizens, but if we, it's still our agenda with public education. You start your piece with two questions. One is, how ought we to live side by side, not as lone individuals, but as citizens, and how can we, through education, help individuals answer that question? Do you think that first question is being asked at all in our society today?
Well, it is. It's a hard question to ask because several things have happened. One with the very long historical process of suburbanization, and although there are these large cities and urban centers we have, which are kind of metro centers, the truth is that we segregate ourselves, understandably, by where we choose to live and next to whom we choose to live, and therefore we have and with modern technology also. There is a kind of added measure of isolation. People don't really talk to one another, traveling, walking in the street. People are not, it's an amazing phenomenon to watch people talking on cell phones all the time. One wonders, what are they saying, really, and to whom are they speaking? We used to conduct life without that kind of immediate, constant communication or the access to it. But that being said, the other issue, which is more germane, is that there's been an erosion of participation in public schooling through various means. There is, of course, the constant presence of private schools, but then there's also the creation of semi-public schools through the charter school movement, and there's a real wish to break away from the sort of the monopoly of a public school system, which was a little bit more characteristic of an earlier period in the 20th century, but the more terrifying part of it is that the percentage of participation in the political process altogether is not encouraging. So from the extreme of the elections in a place like Ferguson in local areas where the participation rate was under 20%, you have the very low participation in national elections. So in the 2016 election, there's the possibility that we actually will elect a president with a minority of the electorate voting for that individual. The participation rates in the national elections is really shocking, and the current political climate seems to be more interested in preventing people from voting than making it possible for them to do so.
Yeah, let me start with the beginning of your answer, and then I guess work forward, because I do think you touch on sort of how technology is implicating our democracy, and I think that point about the cell phones and about how we communicate online. On one hand, it seems to me that communication is encouraged, but the randomness of that communication is limited, it seems. And that's what it seems to me that you're getting at in your piece to a certain extent, is that we're losing the ability to speak to people over whom we have no control or no predisposition.
Yeah, your point is that you say it's random. It's a little bit less random. So in the social networks, let's say Facebook or even online email or even Googling things that you're interested in, there is a kind of inherent in the algorithms of preferences as consumers result in a segmenting of the community so they you end up talking to like-minded people. The kind of information sources you get line up with your prejudices. So there's not a growth in the extent to which you're forced to confront that which you don't want here. So the technology, as opposed to expanding our access to things that we might not have seen, seems to narrow that which we want to look at, talk to, talk about. It's kind of reinforcing of one's prejudices. So if one is a particular religious group, one ends up getting one's information, talking to people, finding the news filtered through that point of view. So you really don't seem to have a need or a desire to talk to someone who thinks something very different. Within let's say, certain groups. There was a piece that came out about evangelicals rethinking the question of homosexuality. What was interesting about the group is there were evangelicals talking to each other. Perfectly nice. But here was a crisis within a small subgroup. No one having the conversation was an atheist or an agnostic or a liberal Christian. That took an absolutely radical view of how to read scripture.
And
so while the conversation was encouraging, that among the evangelicals, there's some thought that maybe, in fact, God's grace shouldn't be removed from people whose preference is a same-sex preference. That itself a pretty narrow conversation.
Indeed, and so this leads us. Let's talk about you talk in the you write in the piece about the I guess the ideal that emigres that recent immigrants or would be immigrants to this country back in the 20s and 30s they had about and what was sort of I guess in some ways awe inspiring to them about the at the very least the ideal of. American education. What was it about, or what was it that they thought that was so impressive about our education system?
Well, the piece that you refer to was inspired by a talk I had to give at a conference that where part of the conference dealt with the question of the legacy of the European intellectual emigration. In the 1930s and 40s, the United States. So these, some Jewish, largely Jewish, not all, anti-fascist emigres that came to the United States, many of them from German-speaking countries, Austria and Germany, were stunned by the sort of progressive movement of American education. The idea that this was child-centered, that from the earliest time the child was asked his or her opinion to speak. It was not authoritarian. The learning wasn't by rote. We're very influenced by Dewey, the notion that you learned by doing and not by rote memorization. And also struck by the relative common ground that the American school provided, that first it was a common school, which meant that there was certainly some segregation, certainly by race, but some segregation in the white community by ability, you ended up in a classroom with people radically different from yourself. And the idea that part of what you learned was to respect your neighbor's opinion, that this was part of democracy. So religion was a private matter. There was not prayer in school. There was no required religious instruction, which was the norm in Europe, where you went to the religion to which you belonged. So Catholics went to Catholic, Protestant to Protestant. It was not mixed. So you ended up learning to live with someone who was not much like you, and may even come from a different both professional and social class. And it was the melting pot idea seemed to be real. And the most important part is the pedagogy was distinctly anti-authoritarian and made a big deal about participation. And so there was an explicit notion of civics and learning immigrant populations, for example, to learn what it meant to be American and live an American life. And part of that was to respect your neighbor, to talk to your neighbor, and to agree to dissent. So the idea that the patriotism was based on a process of democracy, an ideal of democracy. The trouble now, of course, is that the internet certainly has made this worse, too, that there's so much name-calling, so much vitriol, that if you actually disagree with the other person, the kind of dismissive, nearly violent disapproval, and it comes from the right and the left. So you have, on the transgender issue, for example, tremendous intolerance of people who think differently. And on the very far right, you have similar issues having to do with matters of religion or, the sort of vitriolic denunciation of people who think differently about the role of government. Now people don't use communists and socialists as easily because no one cares about that stuff anymore. No one really thinks anybody believes it. But people are... the tone of the political debate does not encourage dissent. In fact, you feel constrained from saying what you think because you don't want to be attacked. You don't want to be pilloried. The internet is viral, literally viral. So you can't even speak aloud. You have to be very careful what you say because things can be taken out of context, reformulated, look like they're accurate, placed in what seem to be newsworthy forms. There's no censor for it. So even misrepresentation is not protected. You know, in the old days, where you had something like newspapers and radio and then television, that seemed to have an editorial oversight, which means you couldn't simply assert anything and get away with it. That isn't the case on the internet now. So the entire combination deters people from engaging people whom they don't know ahead of time already have signed on to a set of premises.
I want to stay first with the emigres and what they saw about education, and take up maybe what you're suggesting about the internet, because I'm frankly not as convinced that it's very possible the level of vitriol is higher online, but I'm not convinced that's so much of a problem. And I'm also, frankly, not convinced that these newspapers, the editorial process was as diligent as we sort of reflect on it. It's just that we didn't necessarily have the means to know any differently. Right?
Oh, no, listen, I don't disagree that I'm trying to portray what they thought was the reality. I don't disagree. I'm not having a nostalgic episode about how great it was in the past. I'm not prone to nostalgia of this kind. Certainly invented historical nostalgia. There was no perfect time. I make a point in the piece, among other things, that the question of race relations in any of these period of the 40s and 50s was horrendous. Bad as our situation is now, it was worse then. So I agree with you. There's nothing better about the past in some way. I do think the present forces some real problems. I don't think the internet is as neutral or as positive as it might be.
I would agree with that broadly speaking too. But let me just go back to this notion where the emigres saw at least the ideal of this of American education as basically in some respects public education to be if not a great equalizer at the very least more equalizing in some respects. and not and also sort of equalizing in terms of it seems on some level of class. I mean, as an emigre, you come in and I think you would be very sensitive to the idea of like or an expectation. I'm going to be on the bottom of the totem pole and there's going to be a lot of people trying to keep me there. And particularly right. if you're coming from Europe, it's not even a question of people trying to keep me there. There's no question as to whether or not anyone would need to try and keep me there because that's where I am and that's where I'll always be. And so that
Yeah, they're absolutely right. There is an aspect of social mobility that American education seemed to provide the European immigrants in the 20th century. Public education did provide that ladder of access.
And also ideological mobility, right? I mean, it, not just in terms of I can better myself in terms of an economic standing, but that my ideas will actually be listened to in this environment.
Yes, the amazing thing for a European, highly educated Europeans, was the absence of an authoritarian bent. It's ironic when we look at it from education today, because we are now in the grips of this very, very rigid standardized testing, teach to the test standardization of the material, which is really reprehensible, a kind of what has since the mid-20th century kind of retreat from these progressive ideas, but in the 40s and 50s, the American school still was dominated by the Deweyite ideal that the training of the young child to express him or herself was one of the points. That there was kind of an inherent anti-authoritarianism to the education. So it wasn't as if you were forced to memorize and study one set of things. Your opinion in writing a paper in high school about something you read was the point, how well you expressed your opinion and that you formulated your opinion as opposed to getting the answer right. This kind of distinction. And certainly when the Americans got frightened of the competition with the Russians and they went into science education with a heavy emphasis, there was also an American sensibility that went into graduate education at the American university. So the scientist in the lab was prized by the extent to which the young scientist could challenge orthodoxy quickly. And there wasn't the university system by which you had a senior faculty member that dominated the entire department until he retired, which was the European system. And the universities were, in that sense, far more pluralistic and more imaginative and prized younger generational contributions much more than the European. So this made a big impression on them.
And you also say that while for Dewey, The justification for this pedagogical system was about teaching and learning. For these emigres, these European emigres, they could see the value of it in terms of creating citizens, and maybe.
And yeah, Dewey thought that too. I mean, Dewey had a real conviction that the system of education connected with the system of politics. So your points exactly on the central issue that concerned the emigres. They also, after 1945 in Germany, a bunch of social theorists began to look at American pragmatism and American educational philosophy. They thought, as did the Russians after the fall of communism, many of them took a look at American practices, Anglo-American practices, and said, maybe there's a connection between the way we educate and the kind of politics we have. So you have this authoritarian educational system that's top-down. Maybe that's not the way you educate people who have to participate in a democracy. So, yeah, they were enamored of the idea that the educational system that prized debate, thought, subjective confidence in one's opinion, that also didn't segregate people by ability at the age of 11, 12, or 13, in other words, at early adolescence, which in the European system, the tradition was you didn't go to a common high school and then have access to university. You actually got segregated by ability groupings, often that were correlative mostly with social class, and you ended up going, a minority ended up going to secondary schools that permitted entrance to the university. So in America, this common school, common high school, all of this seemed terribly optimistic.
And you say that was the good news. The bad news was is that either in reality or there was a perception that American standards were low.
Yes, yeah, but the price that was paid, obviously, which, you know, every person of a certain age in the United States who encountered emigre faculty members in American universities, was that the American achievement levels were very low. So all the socialization took place. You knew how to play with your neighbors in the sort of playground next to the school. But did you really learn mathematics, history, politics, science at the same level as in the more seemingly rigorous French or German secondary system? And so, especially on the collegiate level, on the undergraduate level, there was a kind of astonishment at how ignorant Americans were, except in science. I think science is the one area, because of America's primacy as an industrial nation and the tremendous concern for the connection between higher education and economics, that America already by the 20s and 30s had become a powerhouse in science and both applied science, engineering, and pure science. But nonetheless, the sort of cultural education of the average American seemed below that of a comparable European, and that was ascribed to relatively low standards of curriculum. The other thing was that there were low standards of teaching. The big difference between Europe and America from their point of view is that in America, school teaching, public school teaching, has never been the prized profession that it was in Europe. So a secondary school teacher in Europe is an honored individual, a person of standing and stature. It was not the case in the United States.
So let me ask you, I mean, that perception, I have a two-part question. A, was that perception and is that perception reality? And by that I mean, when we bring more people into the system, where we don't weed out people at younger ages and sort of steer them into vocational tracks or other tracks, we allow everyone to sort of remain in that same track of education. One, is that assessment real? And two, if it is the reality, is there a certain inevitability that if you're going that there's a trade-off? You either allow for a unitary system where all boats are lifted a little bit less, or you allow for a system where you focus on a smaller number of boats and they rise a little higher.
Well, it's a very good question. There's no question that our school system underperforms. Now, I think the structure of its underperformance has many causes. Among the causes is, in fact, something that the right complains about, which is wild overregulation. And the other is low standards, which is really you can put at the feet of the education profession, particularly the schools of education and the primary training instruments of American teachers. The third is, of course, the dominance of a separate system of education schools. And we don't actually treat teachers, public school teachers, as real professionals. So we don't end up recruiting and keeping the best talent in the schools. So I think that the real cause for our low standards is not whether we segregate or we don't segregate, is that we have just very poor, by a reasonable comparison, to places we like to compare ourselves to, Japan or Finland or Korea. The fact is a much, much more distinguished group of people go into teaching professions in those nations than in the United States.
But don't the students also enter in on a much better and more equal footing? I mean,
the universality of early childhood, there are certain social services that end up providing that result. So we have an extremely uncertain record in how we treat populations in terms of access to early childhood.
Right. I mean, if your inputs are such that we have far more and far more kids who are living in extreme poverty, we have kids who have a vastly disparate experience in their first 4 years of life. Once they enter into the public education system, I mean, ultimately, the outputs, as it were, are going to be implicated by the disparity in those inputs.
Totally. And the worst case examples are the inner cities. And it also cuts across race lines as well. Although the deficit, American educational deficit, is felt both in white and black, but the black is more severely impacted by poor educational resources, the kind by poverty, by unemployment or underemployment. So yeah, the social injustice and social inequality in the country is extreme in my view when you compare it to nations of comparable industrial or per capita wealth in the aggregate sense. The other, of course, is that we also have a more heterogeneous population, so it's much more important to compare us to Japan or Finland is always tricky,
right?
Because they have much more homogeneous populations than we do. So, and the other problem in the United States is that we have an incredibly antiquated system of funding, financing, and governing our schools. So you have millions of small districts with the average stay of a superintendent of fewer than 3 years, and you have local political control over small districts, which really doesn't make a lot of sense, and overwhelmingly too much burden on states and local districts, some on property taxes, for the funding. So, and then you add to that the immense bureaucracy that comes from this patchwork quilt of governance, you have a very inefficient and poorly producing school system.
Right. And you made the point in your piece that when you compare where we were in terms of, like, for instance, the high school completion rates at the end of the Second World War versus now, we're actually doing significantly better. And so there's a certain inevitability, it seems to me, that if you're bringing more people along for the ride, you are necessarily bringing people who are not the top students, right? Because the top students are going to come for that ride.
The two questions, you're absolutely right. The two questions that I would ask are, one, top student, there's in certainly standardized testing, there's an inherently recalcitrant correlation between wealth and performance on the tests. And so how much is better a function of a certain social standing? So that's one. The second is, even if you accept that there's going to be a distribution, what is the minimum standard? And that goes back to your original question about citizenship. What's the minimum standard? My view is, yes, you're not going to have a perfect circumstance, but if you're going to graduate between 50% and 80%, preferably 80% of the population, perhaps 100% of the population at age between 16 and 18 with a high school diploma, what's the minimum that's reasonable to expect that they would have learned?
Right.
And there is where my dispute. The outcome will be differential. Not everybody will come out ready to go to the University of Michigan and succeed at the University of Michigan. But it may be that the minimum standard, when someone has a high school diploma, the reason you have some dropout rate is because the quality of what you would achieve at the end of the end of the line. Look at the rate of remediation that's required in community colleges. In our community colleges, where the graduation rate is, let's say, below 17%, part of the problem is that, you know, three-quarters of the time is spent remediating what should have been learned in high school.
Right. And I guess, and in some respects, I mean, I was going to jump to, you know, sort of the looking ahead in terms of what the challenges we face. And that's, I think you list that as the second challenge, indeed, is that we need to have better outcomes. And I guess, you know, we'll leave for the moment the question of how to achieve that, because I agree with you. Obviously, if you have to, you're doing remediating in community college, there's a real problem in high school. But I suspect that the problem then goes, there was a problem in junior high and there was a problem in elementary school. And it really, you know, it, we you start out with at such a deficit that you're always playing catch up with a lot of students throughout the year.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a very, very reasonable and very oft said thing, which is why there is any investment that can be made in preschooling and the access to better nutrition, care, and surroundings for very small children is very good. But I am to believe also that early adolescence is a time you can intervene. We've had very good results, for example, in the seven public high school early colleges we have put into place. The newest is opening in Baltimore this fall. So we have one finished its first year in Cleveland. We're graduating our first class from one that's been around for 4 years in Newark. And since 2001, we have two in New York, and we have two-year programs less complete, one in the Harlem Children's Zone, one in New Orleans. So we're actually in this line of work, and we discover that all is not lost, that there are moments of intervention. I happen to think the high school and late middle school period, the connection between education and adolescence in the United States, is the weakest link. Mm. For all that one can be said about the deficit that one inherits, from the kind of inequality you're talking about, there is another moment where the link between the cars on the train of life when it comes to education separate, break. And that's when adolescence meets education, particularly for males, interestingly. When we do studies of how, let's say, our interventions perform as opposed to the standard public high schools, you'll discover that the real impact is the change of attitude toward learning that overcomes males growing up at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
Do we have a sense of why that is? I mean, not to get too far off our own track here, but why do you have a sense of what that is, or is it just we have no data on that?
I am to think that the most corrosive stereotypes are not so much the discriminatory stereotypes against women. It is the puerile stereotypes about what it means to be a man. So in all the conversation about gender and about gender identity, the lost area is the failure to really provide a serious alternative to strength, sports, combat, conflict, and violence as an emblem of masculinity. So what happens is that when you create an environment where there are different values put forth as compatible with very conventional notions of masculinity, among them being a good student, there's no accident that women overperform against men in elementary and secondary school, especially in adolescent years, because the self-image of feminine seems to somehow cohere with minding one's business and doing well in school, not the male. There is a kind of corrosive, Hollywood-based, popular culture sentiment that the male as student is a kind of nerd, perhaps even the dangerous, geeky scientist. One of the worst purveyors of this is the Hollywood sitcom Big Bang Theory, which is a kind of caricature of successful male scientist. And actually the only attractive character on the show is a dumb blonde. Well, actually smarter on some level than all the other. It's written by very intelligent people, and it's completely corrosive and false. And so if you intervene by creating a different peer sensibility at an early age of adolescence, you can recapture some of the attitudinal shift when young people reach puberty. And you have to do it in a co-educational environment where the image of the gender stereotype gets changed.
Interesting. Well, let's I want to address that that last part where you say towards the end of the piece, we must ask ourselves: do we still believe that American democracy requires a single unitary school system with proper alternatives within that system, but not outside of it? That is in the hands of public instruments of government. And before we address that question, because, I mean, I think, you know, we probably agree on that answer. But, I mean, do you think – I mean, one of the things that I believe is happening in our politics is that the premise of that question is not universally accepted as much as the question implies. In other words – I think that those who push for, not all, but I think to a large extent, those who push privatization, those who push at least a charter as a means to an ends, I should say, as opposed to a means, may not be conscious of it, or maybe they are, but are not terribly interested in democracy.
You know, it's hard for me to don't have enough contact with the people who are in the politics of this to understand their motives. I think many people who support the charter movement, for example, are genuinely concerned about the quality of schools, and they don't see a way of fighting City Hall or a school board or teachers' unions, or let alone the federal government with the imposition of things like Common Core and all the kind of stuff. So they either retreat to homeschooling or some way to elude the heavy hand of kind of mediocre standardization. And so, you know, I don't know enough about what motivates the movement. But there is no doubt that by breaking it up into little pieces, we actually are not furthering the kind of tolerant shared citizenship that we would dream of. So let's forget if it ever occurred, but certainly now that there is, you know, there is a possibility, actually, and a need, a terrible need, for people in red states to talk to people in blue states, for people who don't believe in God, not only to listen to the radio or talk shows or go on the internet to hear their own opinions reinforced, but for those who are skeptical about religion, have a conversation with those who are committed, for people even within religions, whether among Jews or among Christians, that people who are fundamentalists can really understand that there's another way to construe the divine or the understanding of what the teachings of Jesus really are about, that there is a real conversation among people with radically different views. And this has to do with giving up a certain amount of separatism. This is where all the tough issues of whether it's headscarves or wearing skull caps, segregating yourself, using freedom to segregate yourself from the neighbor that doesn't look like yourself, and then to demonize that neighbor, whether it's by color or by religion, is a very terrible moment in which we are supremely intolerant of the people who don't seem to be mirror images of ourselves.
Leon Botstein, the piece is Are We Still Making Citizens in the Current Democracy Journal. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate your calling. Thanks.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein I will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. We have some sound sound from the kid who had the gun pulled on him at the pool party in McKinney, where, what was the cop's name? Case Load or something like that?
Case Bolt.
Case Bolt has resigned.
Case Load works.
Fox and Friends, of course, still, we know who is at fault for what happened at that pool party. I mean, it's quite obvious. Keith Abloh is a psychiatrist. He knows it's President Obama's fault. We also have Rick Perry proving to all of us that you don't get smarter just by putting glasses on. Yes, indeed. All that and more in the fun half of the program. And then we're also going to go through, there's the King v. Burwell announcement will happen within the next 3 weeks. And I believe maybe 4 weeks at the most. And I'm going to get to that story about dirty bombs because, you know, we are establishing or sending about another 400 troops to Iraq in a base ostensibly to recapture Ramadi, I believe it is. And then ultimately Mosul, but that seems to be a year or two off. We are, I don't want to say training Iraqi soldiers, and I don't want to say retraining Iraqi soldiers, because that would be inaccurate. It is, we are retraining Iraqi soldiers from the first four times that we trained them, apparently. And so much of the invasion of Iraq was justified on grounds that not only were hypothetical at the time, but we now know were premised on fabrications that were hypothetical. Literally, we were sold. It wasn't just a question of we've got to do it because otherwise the boogeyman will get you. Well, now we also know not only was the boogeyman not going to get us at that time, and now don't we know that we didn't go because of the boogeyman? We also find out that the boogeyman doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a boogeyman. Insert the words dirty bomb instead of boogeyman, and it will make a lot more sense what I'm talking about, hopefully. Also, the latest on the fast-track vote that supposedly will take place this Friday. Call your congresspeople. You can do it through, I think, Credo Action has calls. We will dig up some numbers and links, Michael, and put that in our post today. Call your congresspeople. And if they're a Republican, tell them, how can you give President Obama more of this power? And if they're a Democrat, you can tell them, you'll join the labor unions. You won't support their candidacy. On and on. I mean, right now the Republicans are trying to work out a means in which to avoid cutting Medicare with the aid of Nancy Pelosi, essentially. So Nancy Pelosi, in public, neutral stance on fast track, behind the scenes, trying to pave the way. So now you know. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll head into the fun half of the program, 646-257-3920. Folks, you know, our app is free, and it's a great way to search the catalog of our show. It's a great way to IM the show, to call the show, to listen to the show, all of it. It's free. MajorityApp.com. Also, we are supported by Credo this month. CredoMobile.com/Majority Report. Check it out. But it still remains the case that membership is what makes this show possible. Day in, day out. The only way we'd be able to do this program. And I hear from a lot of different people who are trying to do what we do. The only way we'd be able to do it is via your support. If you have the financial means to become a member, please do at majority.fm. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's a win-win-win-win for everybody. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. They have free shipping now. Get the Majority Report blend. We drink it. I'm starting to drink too much coffee, I think. But screw it. That's the way I roll now. I'm also going to lay into Jerry Seinfeld again, I think. I know I've done this before, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah. We may be debuting a new...
Foreshadowing.
A new character. Jerry Seinfeld. White culture protector?
Jerry Seinfeld, white supremacist.
Well, that seems a little bit strong. Let's just say he's a defender of white culture.
I'm a defender of the purity of the race.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this.
Just ain't no.